Our linguist Jeff Nunberg likes nothing more than going on the internet and counting words to make points about language, but he's a little unsettled by the way commentators have been using that technique to support their opinions about everything from the House healthcare bill to the president's personality.
The internet makes everybody a linguist, the same way it turns us all into medical diagnosticians and tracers of lost persons. Counting words has become a favorite way to track a trend, uncover a hidden meaning, or cut a long text down to size. So when the House Democrats' 1,900-page health care bill was published, critics on all sides took to counting up its words, whether that actually meant something or not. A feminist group faulted the bill for containing only 8 mentions of women, which is true, but then it doesn't mention men even once. And opponents of the bill tried to distill it to its coercive essence by noting that the word shall appeared in it over 3,000 times. As House Minority Leader John Boehner put it, shall, that means you must do. And the New York Post said it showed that the feds were telling people what to do on every page. But a shall count in the thousands isn't out of line for a major bill from either side of the aisle. And the vast majority of those shalls spell out the obligations of the government and the health plans, not the people. In fact, shall gets a bad rap considering how crucial it is in safeguarding our freedoms. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. The right to bear arms shall not be infringed. Nobody shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process. Page for page, shall is 3 times as frequent in the Constitution as in the House health care bill. Of course, critics of the bill are still free to argue that it usurps our basic freedoms and opens a new fast lane on the road to serfdom. But that isn't something you can prove just by counting helping verbs. It's that same craze for counting that moves commentators to tally first-person pronouns when they want to demonstrate somebody's narcissism. During the 2008 campaign, Frank Rich used that method to tag Hillary Clinton and John McCain as pompous egomaniacs. And after Sarah Palin's speech resigning the Alaska governorship, the Wall Street Journal's Peggy Noonan pointed to Palin's predilection for using I and described her as self-referential to the point of self-reverence. But nobody's pronouns have come in for as much critical scrutiny as Barack Obama's. In Newsweek, Howard Feynman counted the pronouns in the president's UN speech and concluded that he's too impressed with his own aura. Other columnists have sounded the same note. George Will said that Obama was inordinately fond of the first-person singular pronoun and described him as ego-tripping when he used those pronouns 26 times in his speech to the Olympic Committee in Copenhagen. But everybody uses those pronouns a lot. They account for around 6% of our everyday conversation. The question is whether Obama uses them any more than other politicians do. At the blog Language Log, the University of Pennsylvania linguist Mark Liberman compared the transcripts of Obama's press conferences with those of his 3 presidential predecessors. It turned out that Clinton and the 2 Bushes all used first-person pronouns anywhere from 50 to 70% more often than Obama does. And Obama used the pronouns even less frequently in the Copenhagen speech that Will saw as the peak of presidential preening. Stanley Fish took up the same motif in the New York Times. He counted the first-person singular pronouns in Obama's speech on the General Motors bankruptcy and announced that it signaled the emergence of an imperial I, in contrast to the deferential we's and you's that Obama had used in his nomination acceptance speech and his victory speech in Grant Park. Of course, you could argue that it's natural for a politician to use we and you more often in a speech thanking political supporters than in one explaining a policy decision that he's taking responsibility for. But even so, Obama actually used those first-person pronouns less frequently in the GM speech than he did in his speeches in Grant Park or at the Democratic Convention. To Liberman, those misperceptions suggest that Will and Fish are suffering from what psychologists call confirmation bias. If you're convinced that Obama is uppity or arrogant, you're going to fix on every pronoun that seems to confirm that opinion. But you can't help thinking that there's a measure of projection here as well. Will and Fish are neck and neck for the most immodest style in American prose, and it's not surprising that they'd read Obama's impenetrable self-possession as the sign of a bristling ego. When you're a narcissist, every doorknob becomes a mirror. But the real error here isn't in overestimating Obama's self-references, and by the way, Palin doesn't use I and me disproportionately either. It's in assuming that the raw frequency of those pronouns says anything at all. True, that association has a long history. In fact, the word egotism originally referred just to the overuse of I. But the great majority of people's self-references actually signal deference or modesty, not conceit. They're what the psycholinguist Jamie Pennebaker calls graceful eyes. I suppose, I see, I wonder if. Those are a far cry from the self-assertive sledgehammer eyes at the other end of the scale. I feel your pain. I'm the decider. Make my day, punk. I'd be the last person to disparage the usefulness of counting words. The internet and computational tools have transformed the way we do linguistics. But the one thing we linguists know is that counting words isn't very revealing if you aren't listening to them, too.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California, Berkeley.